Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Interpreter Insights Podcast. I'm Terry Hutchinson, your host. Our discussion topic today is going to be the Deuteronomistic history and Joshua, with a special guest, Kevin Christensen. The mission of the Interpreter Foundation is to support the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints through scholarship. We make the latest and best scholarship available to you, whether it's podcasts, journal articles, books, seminars, films, or scripture roundtables. You can find it here at theinterpreterfoundation.org. Now, we invite you to see what Interpreter has to offer. And if you like the podcast, tell your friends about it. You can subscribe to this podcast anywhere you subscribe to your podcast, whether it's Apple, Spotify, Pocket Casts, or any other podcast app. Because the Interpreter Foundation is not owned or controlled by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the comments we make are solely our responsibility. This weekend, the Interpreter Foundation is hosting a conference for a wise purpose in Him, the 2026 Small Plates of Nephi Conference, being held in honor of President Jeffrey R. Holland at BYU. Now, the conference is going to be open to the public, and it's free. The conference will not, however, be live-streamed, but will be recorded and the videos made available on the website. It's sponsored by the Interpreter Foundation and co-sponsored by the BYU Department of Ancient Scripture, Fair Latter-day Saints, Scripture Central, and the Ancient America Foundation, including the Faith Creators Alliance. Regarding the Small Plates of Nephi, President Jeffrey R. Holland wrote, "At least six times in the Book of Mormon, the phrase, for a wise purpose, is used in reference to the making, writing, and preserving of the Small Plates of Nephi. We know one such wise purpose, the most obvious one, was to compensate for the future loss of 116 pages of manuscript translated by the prophet Joseph. But it strikes me that there is a wiser purpose than that, or perhaps, more accurately, a wiser purpose in that. The key to such a suggestion is in Doctrine and Covenants 10:45, quote, "Behold, there are many things engraven upon the small plates of Nephi which do throw greater views upon my gospel." So clearly, this was not a quid pro quo in the development of the final Book of Mormon product. It was not tit for tat this or that, 116 pages of manuscript for 142 pages of printed text. Not so. We got back more than we lost, and it was known from the beginning that it would be so. We do not know exactly what we have missed in the lost 116 pages, but we do know that what we received on the small plates was the personal declarations of three great witnesses, three of the great doctrinal voices of the Book of Mormon, testifying that Jesus is the Christ. For a wise purpose, Ensign, January 1996. In the interest of deepening Latter-day Saint understanding and appreciation of the text, context, and doctrine of 1 Nephi through Words of Mormon, the Interpreter Foundation will hold a two-day conference on May 29th and 30th, 2026, on the BYU campus in Provo, Utah. The conference proceedings will throw greater views on the authors of the Small Plates of Nephi and its contents, thus showing how the Small Plates throw greater views on Jesus Christ and His everlasting gospel. Building locations and available parking are shown on a map that you can access through the website. Conference attendees may park for the day in lots 16A and 2A, as well as the two visitor parking lots, 2V and 2A. Explain to the parking attendant you are attending the Small Plates Conference. We've had several of the presenters at this conference on the program as guests. Many of them are my regular co-hosts and visitors, and in fact, Kevin Christensen, who will be joining me shortly, will be presenting at this conference as well. In the last episode of this podcast, I began a survey of the first four volumes of the Interpreter Journal articles. We've mentioned this before, but if you're new to the podcast, every Friday, the Interpreter Journal releases at least one, and sometimes more, articles. And they've done this ever since the Interpreter Foundation came about in 2012. There are currently 68 volumes and growing. We did the first four in our last episode, and I thought we would do, you know, a group of four or five volumes every couple of months. But I've decided to change my mind, and we're going to do a volume every week before we get into our regular podcast. This will enable us to move through the 68 volumes quicker and to reintroduce the listeners to the articles of the past that they might want to go back and revisit. So in volume five, which is what we'll be covering today, it came out in 2013. It had the fewest articles of any of the volumes that we've covered so far. There's only six. However, they are substantial. And it's really for me, in this volume 5, which is the middle of 2013, there are two more to come, that the Interpreter Journal really started hitting its stride. The first two articles are by Benjamin L. McGuire, Finding Parallels, Some Cautions and Criticism, Part 1. Now, this is a 104-page review of Rick Grunder, who's done a book on CD, Mormon Parallels, a Bibliographic Source, which is 2,088 pages. Now, the abstract of this article: discovering parallels is inherently an act of comparison. Through comparison, parallels have been introduced frequently as proof or evidence of different issues within Mormon studies. Despite this frequency, very few investigations provide a theoretical or methodological framework by which the parallels themselves can be evaluated. This problem is not new to the field of Mormon studies, but has in the past plagued literary studies more generally. In part one, this review essay discusses present and past approaches dealing with the ways in which parallels have been used and valued in acts of literary comparison, uncovering the various difficulties associated with unsorted parallels, as well as discussing the underlying motivations for these comparisons. In part two, a methodological framework is introduced and applied to examples from Grunder's collection in Mormon Parallels. In using a consistent methodology to value these parallels, this essay suggests a way to address the historical concerns associated with using parallels to explain both texts and Mormonism as a historical religious movement. This was a fascinating article in which Brother McGuire did an excellent job of identifying how parallels work and should work in historical criticism. And he uses great scholars from early Christianity like Larry Hurtado, as well as others. Grunder's book was obviously an attack on the church. And so ultimately, this volume points out the fallacies of his arguments, and it's well worth spending the time on. Following that was another article by Brant Gardner, When Hypotheses Collide, Responding to Lyon and Minson's When Pages Collide. At the end of 2012, Jack M. Lyon and Kent R. Minson published When Pages Collide, Dissecting the Words of Mormon, in BYU Studies. They suggest that there is a textual evidence that supports the idea that Words of Mormon 12 through 18 is the translation of the end of the previous chapter of Mosiah. The rest of the chapter was lost with the 116 pages. But this text remained because it was physically on the next page, which Joseph had kept with him. In this paper, the textual information is examined to determine if it supports that hypothesis. The conclusion is, while the hypothesis is possible, the evidence is not conclusive. The question remains open and may ultimately depend on one's understanding of the translation process much more than the evidence from the manuscripts. And I can't think of anybody better to write this analysis than Brant Gardner, who's written a 6-volume commentary called Second Witness, which is on the Book of Mormon. But he's also written about the Book of Mormon translation process and the Book of Mormon historical processes. We've interviewed him here on the Interpreter Foundation. He has done a critical edition of the original manuscript of the Book of Mormon. Text of the Book of Mormon, and as well as another analysis, and he's currently serving as one of the editors for the Interpreter Journal. But back in 2013, he wrote this brief article in response to this BYU Studies article, and the great thing about it is there are 36 comments. And eventually, 6 years later, he and Jack Lyon had a very thoughtful and information-filled discussion about the various articles. And Lyon was not offended by anything that Gardner said in this article about the scholarship that he had engaged in, but they had a great interchange, and I recommend that you look at that if you want to. And that's when I really began to appreciate the Interpreter Foundation and the free research and scholarship that it provides to all of us. Following that article, there's another one by Roger Nicholson that's incredibly valuable. The Spectacles, the Stone, the Hat, and the Book, a 21st Century Believer's View of the Book of Mormon Translation. Now, Brother Nicholson has contributed to the Interpreter Foundation before, but this is the abstract from the article. This essay seeks to examine the Book of Mormon translation method from the perspective of a regular, non-scholarly, believing member in the 21st century by taking into account both what is learned in the church and what can be learned from historical records that are now easily available. What do we know? What should we know? How can a believing Latter-day Saint reconcile apparently conflicting accounts of the translation process? An examination of the historical sources is used to provide us with a fuller and more complete understanding of the complexity that exists in the early events of the Restoration. These accounts come from both believing and non-believing sources, and some skepticism ought to be employed in choosing to accept some of the interpretations offered by some of these sources as fact. However, an examination of these sources provides a larger picture, and the answers to these questions provide an enlightening look into church history and the evolution of the translation story. This essay focuses primarily on the methods and instruments used in the translation process and how a faithful Latter-day Saint might view these as further evidence of truthfulness of the restored gospel. Brother Nicholson has written a couple of other Interpreter Foundation articles, one of them in the very first volume called Mormonism and Wikipedia, the Church History That Anyone Can Edit. And this is one of the first times I think somebody fully addressed some of the challenges faced by those who were looking on the internet and found out about the history in ways that surprised them. And he also points out something I've argued for a long time, that most of the information like that is intentionally slanted to try and challenge someone's belief in Joseph Smith. Following that is a book review, Temple Mysticism, an Introduction by Margaret Barker, and that review is by Kevin Christensen, who will be my guest joining me in a few minutes. And finally, Matt Bowen weighs in the Mount of the Lord it shall be seen and provided, theophany and sacrifice as the ideological foundation of the temple in Israelite and Latter-day Saint tradition. And Matt has been a longtime contributor to the Interpreter Foundation. He's recently co-published a book with Jeff Bradshaw about Abraham. I'm working on a Meridian review for that. He will be presenting at the conference as well, and he's done a lot of work on word study and how it applies to the gospel. And this is one of his first contributions. It's obviously going to be appropriate to revisit that one, considering that we're studying the Old Testament this year, and the temple and its ceremonies, to me, are the foundation of the Old Testament's message about Jesus Christ, because that was the whole purpose of the Law of Moses for that. So, that being said, we'll move on to the next phase of our broadcast, and we'll welcome Kevin Christensen to our program. My special guest and friend is Kevin Christensen. He's been on with us before. Welcome to the podcast, Kevin.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
I should say welcome back.
Oh, thanks.
So I've invited Kevin because between now and the end of July for Come Follow Me, we will be talking specifically about what is known as the Deuteronomistic history.
Yes.
I hope I said that right.
Close
I'm going to try and avoid it. I'll tell you what, charge me a dollar, Kevin, every time I screw it up.
That would not be nice.
Exactly. Well, it'll be the opposite of a swear jar.
Yeah.
Kevin, tell us what we mean when we refer to the Deuteronomistic history that way.
Okay. So In books like Richard Elliot Friedman's Who Wrote the Bible, that's probably the most accessible and popular description of the theory of the Bible. But there's one of the sources that they talk about is the Deuteronomists, and this was an ideological group that enters the scene around the time of King Josiah. I mean, they've had precursors around, but this is when they really kind of took hold, because Friedman shows you evidence that they produced a history of the books from Deuteronomy, Joshua, First and Second Kings, and that they had an edition of the book that came out, and it's based on earlier sources and things. So they didn't just make it up at the time; they used stuff and produced an edition specifically to honor King Josiah and say he was the greatest king ever, and to promote their reading. Their values of the scriptures. And so it's distinctive which divine titles they use, which they don't use, and their footprints are all through these texts, you know, with Joshua or Deuteronomy, just the last of the books of Moses, and it purports to be like the last lecture that Moses gives before they go enter the promised land. So with Joshua, that's entering the promised land and the conquest. Judges has most of the concentration of the most horrific stories in the Bible are in Judges. And I have a book that did point out that you're not supposed to appreciate everything bad that happens in Judges just because it's a biblical book that's trying to show you the decline of Israel with some of the things that happen. And then with 1 and 2 Samuel, that's when Samuel calls Saul, and then Saul leads to David, and then goes through the Davidic dynasty, and then eventually a whole bunch more kings, and time passes until you get to Josiah, who's kind of the turning point when things go south for Israel permanently, and Jerusalem is destroyed, the temple is destroyed, and then there's the exile, and there's various prophets are writing at the same time, the most prominent being Jeremiah. And there's controversy about whose side Jeremiah was on in the composition of the history. And like in the first edition of Friedman's, who wrote the Bible, he actually makes the suggestion that Jeremiah might be the Deuteronomist. He says that as a possibility. Then he goes on and he makes this, I think, a stronger suggestion that he says, well, maybe it was Baruch, who was Jeremiah's scribe. And but there's different takes on it. But I think just to be informed about this stream of thought, it's something to be aware of. And there's an article in at the church LDS.org that's really good for this. If you look at, actually, it's this chapter for this month. There's a little section called the Historical Books of the Old Testament.
It's in the Come Follow Me manual that you can get on your phone, right?
And so, yeah, it's in the Come Follow Me, and you're just looking at this, and they have a little section called the Historical Books of the Old Testament. And the important thing is they say right here, naturally, these stories are told from a certain point of view. Just as it's impossible to look at a flower, rock, or tree from more than one angle at a time, it's inevitable that a historical account will reflect the perspective of the person or group writing it. And so this is a good section talking about it. I actually recommended that to a friend of mine who had some questions about how we should take some of these stories. And that one in the church manual, it's actually really good. It's not a not it's not disturbingly academic, but it shows just an awareness of just the human nature of these things. And one of the things, say, that the Book of Mormon is really good at, better than most of the other scriptures, is that it's telling you who's writing the book and why, or in each of the books, actually.
So you can
And
see their point of view.
you can see their point of view. You can see Nephi as an author. You can see Jacob as an author. You can see, the subsequent writers, Enos and Jerem and Omni and those. And then you can see Mormon and Moroni as distinctive editors who are using sources, to do their book. And like Grant Hardy's work is really good at that. But this kind
Well,
of
Grant Hardy
thing.
is one, and the other one I would recommend is Greg Dundas.
Yes.
Because he's done a new one from Religious Studies Center. You and I interviewed him on the Interpreter Radio a
Yeah,
few
okay.
years back.
Yeah, so just the idea that these books have a perspective and they're not written from the perspective of God, but they're written to teach us about God from the perspective of men and women who had significant encounters.
So if I understand it right, take the Deuteronomistic history with a grain of salt
Well, take it with an
to a degree.
awareness of its perspective, that it has a perspective, and that there
Yeah.
are other writings that have a different perspective. For instance, especially say, the stuff that I've written on this, of course, and then like Neil Rapley has and Val Larson both written about how you can explain the conflicts between Nephi and Lehi and Laman and Lemuel with an understanding of what the Deuteronomists were up to, and you can that kind of accounts for the conflicts within the family better than just assuming, well, Laman and Lemuel were the bad guys and they behaved this way because they were bad, and they behaved this way because they had accepted this other approach to reading the scriptures. And it's like when in 1 Nephi 13, when it talks about plain and precious things being lost, but it says no, there's also the covenants of the Lord, and there's also this stuff is very valuable, it's important. But some of the stories, once we get the basic idea what the stories are, what the Ten Commandments are, and what's going on, who Saul is, who David is, who Joshua is, we have to put this together as an ongoing process. And so part of the process is just learning a few stories. And then over time, on that framework of the stories we know, we can get a better understanding of who they were and what they were and how the books were written and how we can apply it to ourselves and lessons that we should take that may not be exactly what a particular author might have in mind, you know, like when.
Well, So there's, I think the best example of this is the stories that are in Samuel and Kings about some of the kings are told completely with a different emphasis in the books of Chronicles.
Yes.
Okay. They call it the chronicler and then, you know, the Deuteronomists.
Yeah. And the chronicler has a different perspective sometimes on the same things. And the, like Margaret has an essay that she,
Margaret Barker,
when she went to, Logan, and she has one on, the hidden book and the hidden, you know, the temple hidden in Kings, the idea that the Chronicles accounts have a lot more details about the temple.
Yes.
That the Deuteronomistic writers suppressed. And so one of the titles for an old copies of the books of Chronicles is The Things Left Out. And a lot of times, like as a missionary, sometimes, you know, to give evidence that there were, that the Bible isn't complete, inerrant, and sufficient, we would point to books like the book of Gad the Seer or the book of Nathan or something like this that's mentioned as a source used by the authors of Chronicles. We don't have those books, but the people who put together Chronicles did. So there's stuff that they had that we've lost, and they refer to these books that they're using sometimes. And so that's helpful. And that can kind of account for, in some cases, differences at some points between Kings and Samuel and Chronicles, because we have different sources and we can look at them and see different perspectives. And part of the reason I think we have them all in the scriptures is that it's an invitation from God to us to consider the story that the differences tell, and not just the stories as they're presented by each author, but sometimes the differences.
So give us an example of one of those differences that you've found as you've pondered these issues over the years.
Okay. Well, say one example, say between the, like, that I often cite in Jeremiah versus the Deuteronomist, there is a spot in Deuteronomy where it says, you don't need anyone to go up to heaven to receive the mysteries. You've got it all written down in the book right here in front of you. So you don't need anyone to do that. And in Jeremiah, you have places where Jeremiah says that he's been invited, you know, to go up to heaven and to learn the mysteries and find it out from God. So there's a lot that they have in common, you know, and there's the standards of righteousness in Deuteronomy are very applicable, and the tolerances in Deuteronomy are very beautiful and applicable. But there's places where theologically they have some differences, and they use different divine titles, like in the title Lord of Hosts is very rare in Deuteronomy because they didn't like the idea of the host. So out the title goes. Jeremiah uses that title, I think, at least 80 times. So the names that people use for God can be a way to see how what their personal experience with God was. Someone who has gone into the, you know, heavenly council like Lehi and sees numberless concourses of angels and the attitude of praising their God will like the title Lord of Hosts.
Mm-hmm.
Someone who just thinks of God as, you know, the one, where it's all has to be this title, absolute oneness, and this thing where there's just the one strict absolute monotheism, would have a problem with that title. And so we can see a little bit of some of that going on. And like Jack Welch wrote an article about divine titles used, you know, by different Book of Mormon authors, and he shows how each of them, the titles that they use reveal something of their personal encounters with God as they go through their lives. You know, like say Abinadi talks a lot about the suffering servant. You know, servant. He quotes Isaiah 53 in total, and Isaiah himself suffers.
Yeah,
for his testimony, and he becomes a suffering servant himself, even as he's testifying of the suffering servant. So,
and it doesn't talk about this in the Bible, but it does talk about it in the book of the martyrdom and ascension of Isaiah.
Yes.
And then also referring to the person that was sought in too, talked about in the book of Hebrews in the New Testament. And they assume that was Isaiah because that's how he died in the martyrdom and ascension.
Yeah.
You know, well, as I look at this, Kevin, and I see the stories of the kings in particular, and of Joshua and Judges, you were pointing out earlier, Judges, it talks about a lot of bad stories.
Yeah.
Not really any good ones. But that doesn't mean there weren't good ones. It just means that this is what they were reporting, right?
Yeah. And there's a purpose in telling disturbing stories is you want people's morality to be disturbed. You know, like when Jephthah's daughter, he says, you know, I'm so happy that I've won this battle. I'll sacrifice the first thing that I see. And the first thing he sees is his daughter.
Uh-huh.
And he goes through with it.
Yeah.
And we're not supposed to think, oh, what a good man. We're supposed to think this is insane. And that kind of thing happens, you know, quite often in the Judges account. And
well, that story also has parallels in Greek mythology.
Yeah.
Or at least Greek history, right?
Yes. And we're Christians. We're not, we don't worship Zeus because there's stuff going on in Greek. I mean, I love Greek mythology, but there's stuff going on in there that's disturbing. And sometimes it's meant to be. It's not just that we're in a different culture, but sometimes it's supposed, despite, you know, whatever culture we're coming from, we're having a moral encounter with what's going on. And there's the lessons, you know, that Jesus tells, and he draws on the Old Testament. He quotes Deuteronomy and all this, and he quotes Jeremiah. And so he's aware of the stories, and it's to know the stories, to learn, you know, even bits of them it's a place to build and to start. And there are good lessons in the stories that we tell the most because we recognize the goodness in them.
I think of the point you were making about the term Lord of Hosts, but there's also one where we talk about the kings, because Deuteronomy had a very specific stricture about what kings weren't supposed to do.
Yes.
They weren't supposed to have too many horses. They weren't supposed to have too many wives. I can't remember what the others were, but as it turns out, Solomon is portrayed as violating every one of those strictures.
Yes. And so, that's part of what's going on is they've come up with a way of viewing the world and a moral framework that they want to adopt. And everyone that falls short, it's because they fall short on this set of standards.
But it's a standard set out by Moses in Deuteronomy. Like the one God, the Lord of hosts.
And
it's fascinating, isn't it? You have you have Saul anointed by a prophet, falls.
Yeah.
David anointed by a prophet, falls. Solomon anointed by a prophet, falls. I mean, and out of the however many kings, 20 or 30 that are mentioned, 8 of them are kind of good, and really only 2 or 3 are treated as being very good. And as you said, Josiah is treated as the most righteous of all.
Right. Yeah.
And that was because he found the book of the law of the Lord in the temple, or somebody did, and then he promoted it and read it, and that's what they followed. And he lived during Lehi's early life.
Lehi would have been alive. I think he was born during Josiah's reign.
Mm-hmm.
I figured it. Once I started thinking about it, I realized that.
I mean, this is speculation to a certain degree.
Yeah, but
because we don't know how old Lehi was.
No, but he's not the old, you know, he's got to be old enough when they get to Bountiful to be able to have 2 sons at least. They're at Bountiful. Jacob is born just before they get on the ship, and Joseph too. So, and they may have been twins, but so they have to be young enough to be able to have kids when they start on the boat. And that's, they had 8 years from when they left Jerusalem. So, he wasn't the old graybeard when they found the Liahona. He's prime of life, Lehi, at that point. And he would have been starting to have his kids toward the end of Josiah's reign. And then the 4 oldest sons, Laman and Lemuel, Sam and Nephi, would have grown up to at least late adolescence and early adulthood when Jehoiakim is king. And then the Book of Mormon starts, and Nephi has to be exceedingly young but large in stature so that he can be mistaken for Laban. For Laban. And of course, people would have been shorter at that time, just because that's the way that it was. But, relatively within that community. Yeah. So we do have to think a little bit about what we're reading and what makes sense, and not just kind of go from the illustrations we've seen, because, the artists are always working from assumptions at the time. But that's another thing. I mean, we have lots of resources that help us, and I think it's good that Interpreter and Scripture Central and the Come Follow Me do provide additional resources that will help give us some better background so that we can get more out of the scriptures that we read. And that includes the stories in right now when the we're on. We're on
Joshua.
Joshua, and
And
I
Judges.
listen to Lynn Hilton. My wife and I like to listen to the video podcast that like Lynn Hilton Wilson does every week. So we watch those every week, and there's some of the others that we watch. So there's for people who like videos, they're there. For people who like the lessons, they're there. For people who want to go deeper, there's all of these books from thousands of books. I once read that the purpose of a canon is to generate commentaries. So one of the things that the scriptures do is it generates commentaries, people trying to find out what's going on, or to say this is what I see from my perspective. And like there's a really good essay by speaking of Deuteronomy, there's a really good essay by Hugh Nibley in What Is Zion a Distant View called How to Get Rich. And it's a commentary specifically on Deuteronomy. And so there's aspects of that that he uses, and of course he has his own agenda when he's writing, and he does it very well on that one. And there's other people that they're going to be more interested in the histories. And I think I was going to mention there's a couple of essays, say, one by Bill Hamlin that's like a review, a response to some of the more atheistic approaches to the scriptures, and he's able to cite some things that give a better approach. And John Gee does a review of a book by, I think, Kenneth Kitchen that kind of supports
Oh,
the
on the
historicity.
reliability of the Old
Yeah, on
Testament.
the reliability of the Old Testament.
That's
So
one of
there are things like
John's,
this.
recommendations to
Yeah,
me.
and those are good recommendations. So at different times in our life, we want to have support and have questions for these. So we seek out of the best books words of wisdom, and we seek from the authors we know, and that leads to authors we don't know, and that leads to insights we never would have thought of if left to ourselves, and that's mind expanding and enlightening. So
But
that's
when
fine.
we, I think when we look at this section of the Old Testament, the Deuteronomistic, I owe you $3, Kevin, history. If you held a gun to my head, I don't think I could say it right.
All right.
But when we study
Sure.
that, it helps me because all of a sudden I think, well, now wait a minute, because, and I've talked about this on the air before. A good friend of mine is Stan McConkie down in St. George. I don't live there anymore. Stan is working in the temple and he's retired now, but he used to ride his bike and he would come into my law office when I was the only one there. I'd have the door open about 8 o'clock in the morning and he'd have been riding his bike and he'd just come in and I'd hear the clacking of his bicycle shoes and he'd open the door and say, "Brother Terry, let's talk about King David."
Yeah.
And those were some of the most wonderful conversations that I had about King David, because David is the classic example of someone who was risen by the hand of the Lord directly and miraculously, and then who later fell. And yet, the story of David, particularly as it's in the books of Samuel, you wonder about that when you look at the way all the other kings are treated. They're almost uniformly bad by the Deuteronomists. And
Yes.
so I look at this and say, well, wait a minute. And I'm not saying that David's good or anything else. I'm not saying this to excuse him, but I'm saying perhaps there's more to the story here.
Yeah.
And so we'll have to see the rest of the story, as it were, when we get to the other side.
Yeah,
But it's
and
almost the analogy I always give myself is, what if the priests of Noah, who, in my opinion, are clearly Deuteronomists,
yes.
wrote the history of Mosiah, Benjamin, and Mosiah?
Yeah, and they may have done.
How would they have portrayed that?
Yeah.
What, I mean, it would be completely different than what we have in Mormon's editing.
Yeah, and Richard Bushman wrote an essay on, the Nephite view of the story, or the Lamanite view of the
The
story,
Lamanite
pardon
view of the Book
me.
of
The
Mormon.
Lamanite view of the story. So things
I
like this.
remember that.
And they can be very interesting, and it kind of opens up our eyes. There's the thing Brigham Young said that I really like. He says, "There is one principle I wish to urge upon the saints in a way that it may remain with them, and that is to understand men and women as they are and not as you are." And it's an invitation to get outside of our own shoes and to see. And it should expand our mind and our understanding just to realize why people are that way instead of just saying, well, that can't be right because it's different.
So, having said all of this, what are a couple of the sources that you've got that our listeners could tap into to get a little more background on this? You've got
Okay.
some and I've got some. So why
Yeah.
don't you take one, I'll take one, and we'll just take turns.
Okay. So, well, I think first and foremost, since we're just going through the lessons, I think just to look at the resources, say at Scripture Central and Interpreter, that are be supplements to the manual, and because it's to try and help us have a firm foundation in starting with the stories. And the lessons that we can most immediately take to mind. So some of the other stuff is exciting later, but we have to start somewhere. And I think starting somewhere just to get a good grasp of, the stories of, in this case, Joshua coming into the promised land, and the story of Rahab, the harlot, and why she's a significant figure, and why they eventually even say that, some of the kings and even Jesus himself can trace his line back that far. And they're telling these stories for a purpose, and it's an odd story, but yet it's showing that God is aware of more people that we might not think about are on his list and uses them to help Israel.
So those are great sources. Another one for me is that this year, the Religious Studies Center released a second volume in a series called The Old Testament Through the Lens of the Restoration. The title of this one is From Wilderness to Monarchy. And the first four articles cover this period of time that Kevin and I have been talking about, particularly one, Joshua, Successor to Moses, Successful Trailblazer by Jared Ludlow. And then it wraps up with a review of the Book of Judges, written by Aaron P. Shod. Broken laws as every man did that which was right in his own eyes.
Yeah.
And I would point out that Jared does point out in this article a little bit about the fact that Joshua is part of the Deuteronomistic history. Now,
Yeah.
he doesn't really outline it as deep as you and I have. And the reason I invited you to do that is partly because you have so much experience with the Deuteronomists, because that's one of the things Margaret Barker talks about so much.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, what's another one, maybe an outside source that you would refer to?
Well, another so well, I've I, we mentioned this. John Gee wrote an essay in the Farms Review 18-1, 2006, of a book called On the Reliability of the Old Testament by Kenneth A. Kitchen. And he talks about Kitchen's background as an evangelical scholar, but he says that he really likes the book for the most part. And he gives, a couple of things. And of course, this is now 23 years. So it's
I
been,
will tell you that John is very hard to please.
yeah,
When
but he
John
really
likes
likes
a
that
book,
book.
it's kind of
Yeah.
like worth looking at.
And because there's of course there are all sorts of people out there who are quite to one degree or another dismissive of the Old Testament to some degree. And like he also said, there's also William Deaver, and like he has a book called What Did the Bible Writers Know and When Did They Know It? And he's Deaver is a moderate. And there are the people want there are those that want to dismiss the whole thing. There are those that want to insist that it's all all must be perfect, and everything must be right, and our interpretation therefore is perfect. And so, but it's these are different perspectives, but they're helpful perspectives. And sometimes it's something we can use, and sometimes it's something that it's just good to know about so that we know what the discussions are about sometimes, even if we disagree. I mean, that's one of the reasons why I read Friedman in the first place. But I found there's quite a bit that I like in there, and there's I think like Margaret takes things further and sees things that he wouldn't have imagined because she's using different sources and different frameworks.
Yeah,
And of course, we
I
have the
like
book.
Friedman's work too. Now, you and I were talking, and you have two copies of it.
Yes, I have a the second edition, which was the first one that I got many years ago.
And that's the one I
And
have.
yeah, and then I got the third edition because
No, I
he
have
was
the
making
third. I'm
some.
sorry.
I knew there was a third edition, but I wanted to footnote some of the things that he says, and I wanted to make sure they were in an accessible place. So I got the new book, and they're in a very different place. And it took me quite a bit of reading to find out where they were, but the same, the things that I wanted to footnote were there. So just, sometimes 50 or 60 or 100 pages different.
So when you and I were talking beforehand, you held up two of them. I said, well, why don't you send the old one to DI? Let somebody else have it.
Yeah, and says, because I know where things are. It's like the reason that I use my missionary scriptures. It's because that's where all my marks are. And I've been using those. I know how to find what I'm looking for. And if I can just, sometimes my brain will tell me, this part of this book. And so there's a physical aspect of, muscle memory gets involved.
That's wonderful. I like that. You know, another place to look is sometimes extra biblical sources, which are provide us a little bit of a different viewpoint. Josephus is one. And I've got a book by Louis Feldman, published by the University of California Press in 1998, and it's called Josephus's Interpretation of the Bible. And essentially, it's a commentary on the differences between Josephus and how he treated biblical portraits. Particularly, he's got Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, Moses, and Joshua. In Moses's case, one of the things he talks about is how Moses may have been, there are reports that Moses was taken up into heaven. And we see a little bit of that. There's a difference of opinion in how that's written in Deuteronomy, but it looks like somebody came back in and said, oh, well, only God knows, but he was buried. And yet, the vast amount of traditions, especially the non-biblical ones, are that Moses was taken up into heaven. And of course, we believe that as Latter-day Saints. In his new article, Jared Ludlow specifically talks about that because he was, of course, on the Mount of Transfiguration and then later in the Kirtland Temple. And so there's things like that if you really want to go farther afield. But I agree with you, Kevin. I think a great place to start is some of the study aids from Interpreter, also Scripture Central. In fact, some of the Scripture Centrals is a better beginning place, I think, than some of the Interpreter ones, which are a little more advanced or scholarly. And then once you get through that, you progress. And you want to get more and more material, and therefore, I'd recommend Friedman's book maybe a little later in the process. And the first thing I would recommend, though, in particular, is just as you said, there's that section right there in the Come Follow Me manual,
Come follow me,
where they begin to touch on that. For that, I remember a lady in my ward was talking to me after one of my gospel doctrine lessons on the Old Testament, and she just said, I wish I could understand the Old Testament the way you do. And of course, you know, I hang around with you and John all the time, not literally, but virtually. And so I just think, oh gosh, I wish I understood as well as these guys. But really, it is simply a matter of the time and effort that we've put into it because it's taken you years to get to this point and you're still going.
I still feel like an infant in some respects. I mean, and it's I heard a story once about someone listening to a piano player saying, I'd give my life to be able to play music the way you do. And the musician said, I have.
Yeah,
That's what I'm given.
that's what it is.
That's
Yeah,
what I'm given.
exactly. Yeah.
But and also that we sometimes we just have different talents and different aptitudes, and
Yeah,
they're
for
all
sure.
necessary to the community, but we bring them together. And we're supposed to share them in Sunday school and in our family study to share what we've learned with each other and ask the questions that we have where we are to try and get further to where God wants us to be.
Well,
And
and I think we do that as we read. We should
yes.
always be doing that as we read. I
Yeah.
really like the points that you made earlier about how these stories are to tell us certain things on their face, but then as we ponder them, some of the things that are left out of those stories raise other questions
Yeah.
and other things that we can learn and
Yeah. But
benefit from.
there's something when we're talking about Joshua, when he says, choose ye this day whom ye will serve, but as for me and my house, I will serve the Lord. that's something that, you know, you don't have to be a scholar to understand.
It just cuts to the bone
very quickly, and it gets right there, and it stays there. That's something that doesn't go away, no matter how many other books you read. That's still there.
Yeah.
So even those things like that, those moments like that, are why we tell some of the stories we do, is because those are the stories that, you know, face us with the decisions that we make every moment, and decisions that make a difference for our good.
All right. So, Kevin, this is going to run on Thursday. Okay. And you are speaking this weekend where? Tell us a little about that. I mentioned it earlier on the program, but I'm going to give you another chance.
I'm speaking at the Small Plates Conference at BYU. There's information on the program and everything on the Interpreter website. It's free of charge. There'll be, you know, I'm one of the small fries. There's people like Daniel Peterson and Brant Gardner will be there, and John Key and Steve Smoot, Neil Rapley, and a whole bunch of others from the University of Hawaii. Matthew Bowen will be there and talking about the small plates, and it should be an interesting event.
Well, you'll be there personally for a change, and that'll be great for you now that you live here in the West. So congratulations to you. We'll look forward to it. Thanks, Kevin. And thank you for being with us. We'll have you on again. I appreciate your willingness to come on and help me with my mangled pronunciation.
It traps everybody.
For those of you who are listening, thanks for listening to this episode of Interpreter Insights. On behalf of myself and my guest, Kevin Christensen, thank you for listening.
Okay, thanks. Okay.